Welcome to the London School of Economics and this very important speech that we are going to hear. I'm Meghnad Desai. I used to teach here in days gone past, but I'm delighted to be here. One thing that one can say about the Labour Party is that it pioneered thinking about overseas development, starting with, people may have forgotten, Harold Wilson, who founded War and Want, and did the first overseas development administration as part of the government in the 1964 government. In 1997, overseas development was raised to cabinet status, and the commitment of the government to development, we know in the Africa Commission report, in all the moves of G8 and so on. I'm delighted, therefore, to welcome the Secretary of State for International Development, Hilary Benn. Hilary Benn belongs to a family which makes a habit of becoming cabinet ministers, generation after generation, and is at least a third generation cabinet minister we have. I'm not going to say any more than he will tell you what he's going to do, and it's going to be fantastic. Hilary Benn.
Well, Meghnad, ladies and gentlemen, first of all, can I thank you very much indeed for having invited me to join you here today. I'm particularly pleased to have this chance to talk about how we can achieve trade justice, which is probably the most important development challenge facing us today. I can never remember a time, I'm 51 years of age, I can never remember a time when the thing that we call development was more at the centre of the big political debates of our age. Why is that? Because I think we now see more what's happening in other countries. We cannot claim any more. We do not know what is going on. We understand better the means that we have available to us to help make a difference. And we have, in this extraordinary year of 2005, an historic opportunity to do something about it. We have really a moral imperative to act, and we have, as I say, an opportunity in this year to do so. And this coming weekend in Edinburgh, thousands of British citizens, through the Make Poverty History campaign, will make their voice loud and clear in telling us that they want us and other governments to do more to achieve trade justice, because they are right to be angry about unfair trade rules and highly protected markets that work against the poor. They're right to be angry about rich world agricultural subsidies, and they're right to be passionate about the need for change. And it's vital that we act now at this critical time for the Doha round in the run-up to the ministerial meeting in Hong Kong in December. Now, as we know, change is not always easy to achieve, but with political will, we can change things. And one of the most striking things about this weekend will be thousands of people gathering in Edinburgh. Why? Because they want the G8 to do something, and they believe that we have the capacity to take decisions that will change things. It wasn't all that long ago when people would gather before a G8 summit and in effect say, would you all please go away, because we don't want any of the things that you have to offer. And I think we should take from that a message of hope, because it demonstrates that people can see the capacity of the political process actually to change things for the better. And we've had two very recent examples of exactly that. The first was the major and unprecedented breakthrough on aid reached by Europe just over a month ago at the development ministers' meeting that I attended. That is a commitment to double aid by 2010, including to Africa. A total of $40 billion extra a year by 2010, bringing total EU aid to $80 billion a year, and a commitment by the richer EU countries to reach, finally, the long-held UN 0.7% target by 2015. And Britain, of course, has set a target date to achieve that of 2030. We have also seen historic progress on debt. At the G8 finance ministers' meeting earlier this month, ministers chaired by Gordon Brown agreed a proposal to cancel up to $55 billion worth of debt owed by heavily indebted poor countries to the World Bank, the African Development Bank, and the IMF, dropping the debt once and for all. And in the run-up to Gleneagles, we are looking to build on those successes. But the truth is that aid and debt relief alone are not enough. Why? Because if we achieve trade justice, the world's poorest countries will have the chance, with the right support, to set themselves on a sustainable path to higher growth, to more jobs, and increased incomes for the poor. Trade justice will give them the means to end their dependency on aid, the means ultimately to end poverty. And as the Prime Minister said last week, Europe leads the world now on development. It's time to demonstrate the same leadership on trade. Now, for trade to work for poor people and for the poorest countries, seems to me we need three things. First of all, action by developed and developing countries to reduce trade protectionism and end unfair subsidies, which is exactly what we agreed to do at Doha, and that Doha agreement, for the very first time, put the concerns of developing countries at the heart of the WTO. Secondly, we need substantially increased aid to build the capacity of the poorest countries to trade, to earn their way out of poverty. And thirdly, we need action by developing country governments to create the right conditions for trade, for growth, and for poverty reduction. So let's start with what we need to do to create more justice in international trade. Now, we need the WTO to do this. And I strongly disagree with those, and thankfully they seem to be a diminishing number, who call for the end of the WTO. Because the truth is, the problem with the WTO is not that it is too liberal, but in a sense that it is not liberal enough, because it has not responded sufficiently to the needs of two-thirds of its members, developing countries. And it has legitimised some of the worst forms of developed country trade distortions, especially in agriculture. Uniquely, in the WTO, even the poorest have a vote. Advanced developing countries like India, China and Brazil now have real bargaining power. 62 of the poorest developing countries, the smallest players in world trade, in Africa, in Asia and in the Caribbean, have also formed new alliances to try to identify their common interests and to make their voices heard. Now, only with a strong, rules-based, multilateral system will we provide the gains that developing countries need. And if this system were ever to unravel, then it would be poorest countries that would lose out most of all. They would be pitted, like David against Goliath, in bilateral trade negotiations, where they would have, frankly, no collective bargaining power at all. And unlike David, they would not win. Now, next month, a draft document is due to be produced outlining the shape of agreements that will be reached at December's Hong Kong ministerial meeting. Anyone who is concerned about making poverty history must want this round of trade negotiations to succeed. For that to happen, we need to mobilise support internationally. And that's where all our campaigning efforts should be directed. As the Commission for Africa noted, rich country barriers and support are absolutely unacceptable. They are politically antiquated, economically illiterate, environmentally destructive, and ethically indefensible. They must go. Now let me turn to some of the priorities. Agriculture is, of course, crucial. And here the WTO must show real ambition, because in no other area does the unfairness of the current system serve developing countries so badly. Rich country protectionism, the barriers, the subsidies and the support mean that the world supply of agricultural goods is artificially increased and world prices are lowered. While such protectionism continues, the poorest countries will never be able to compete in their own or any other markets around the world against heavily subsidised rich country products. As a minister from a West African cotton-producing country said, "We're very happy to compete with US farmers, but not with the US trade." While 70% of the population of Africa work in agriculture, only a few percent do so in rich countries. Yet rich countries currently support their agriculture to the tune of a staggering $279 billion a year. That's over 10 times current aid to Africa. That's a sum comparable to the income of the whole of sub-Saharan Africa. Market barriers keep out developing countries that have a natural advantage in producing agricultural goods. Average tariffs between rich countries are only 3%, but can rise to over 200% in the US for fruit and nuts, or to 300% in the EU for meat. Through the Common Agricultural Policy, two-fifths of the EU budget goes on subsidies and support to Europe's farmers, who represent 5% of Europe's population and produce less than 2% of Europe's output. Most is not spent in the poorer parts of Europe, where it is needed. Most of it goes to the biggest farming companies and landowners, not small farmers. Nor does it provide incentives for farmers to modernise and compete effectively in the global economy. The cost to the people of Europe is high, and it's hardest felt by the poorest. The cost to the average household in the UK of the Common Agricultural Policy is £832 a year. Over £800 every year lost from family income, from taxes that pay our contribution to Europe's budget, and the cost of overpriced food that Europe's agricultural policies create. In the US, support to cotton farmers of around $3.9 billion a year undermines employment in West Africa, where cotton is produced three times more efficiently than in the United States of America. This must end. Europe cannot lead the world on development when its trade and agriculture policies undermine developing countries' ability to trade their way out of poverty. Now, agricultural reform is possible. A rapid but carefully managed transition will be good for a modern Europe and for North America, as it was for New Zealand, where agricultural reform and an end to much of government support led to a more vibrant, growing and competitive farming industry. And it's important that we recognise that some progress is being made. The EU has committed itself to agree an end date for export subsidies. Now the United States and others must follow suit. And the UK is committed to a 2010 timetable to end all forms of export support. But this is only the first step. For there to be real development gains, market barriers to agricultural products must be eliminated. Current analysis is that we need at least to halve the agreed ceilings on agricultural tariffs if we're to make an impact on the tariffs actually applied. In addition to this, as the Commission for Africa report recommends, our goal is to end all trade distorting support to farmers. The EU has agreed to cut 70% of the subsidies to farmers that are linked to levels of production. Other WTO members should do likewise if we are to deliver real gains to farmers in the poorest countries. In addition, to safeguard the livelihoods of West African cotton producers, all trade-distorting subsidies on cotton must end with immediate effect from the end of the Doha round. And we need to ensure that rich countries do not misuse protection for so-called sensitive products to continue to exclude developing country goods. While the poorest countries should be allowed to maintain tariff protection on products that are important to food security, rural development, and livelihoods. The Kenyan Trade Minister said in London this week, I'm ready to open our market in flours and vegetables, but to open it now to imported maize would be suicide. At the same time, poor countries cannot rely on agriculture if they are to achieve sustained growth. Diversification is key. If countries produce a wider range of goods, then they are less vulnerable to downturns in a particular area. And they need to add more value through processing to agricultural products. UK companies, for example, have invested in Sri Lankan tea production. As a result, over 90% of the value added goes to Sri Lanka. But in Kenya, it is only 5%. So Kenyan tea producers get very little of the price of English breakfast tea on our supermarket shelves. And it's vital that we rich countries do not undermine this stage in their development through further market barriers such as tariff peaks and escalation. Whereas there are 0% tariffs on rubber, turning it into shoes like plimsolls imposes an additional tax of 27% in the United States of America. As for services, I believe that developing countries must be able to choose whether and what to liberalise. This is how it works in the WTO. The WTO does not force any developing country to open its service sectors, not in water, not in anything. But opening up services like telecoms can make a big difference. The lives of poor people in rural areas can be transformed by access to affordable mobile phones. In India, there are now more mobiles than fixed lines, opening up communication in rural areas and increasing growth. In Botswana, liberalisation doubled landline coverage and mobile use increased from zero in 1998 to 250,000 in 2001, serving some 16% of the population. If managed well, with appropriate regulation and under the right circumstances, opening up can be beneficial. For WTO agreements to help the poorest countries capture the gains from trade, countries, of course, need flexibility in the pace and extent to which they introduce trade reforms, to plan and sequence those reforms in line with their own needs. And this needs to be built into each agreement, because their integration into the world economy should be managed as part of their national development and poverty reduction plans, not forced through trade or aid conditionality, not forced through new economic partnership agreements with Europe, not forced through the World Trade Organization. The poorest countries should not be suddenly exposed to global markets where they cannot compete. The WTO must support the inclusion of poor countries in the global trading system, not expose their weaknesses and exacerbate their vulnerabilities to change. Nobody expects Brazil and Burundi to take on the same obligations, or China and Chad. The poorest WTO members must have the flexibility to progressively remove their tariff barriers in a managed way, but they need to build the confidence of their trading partners by binding and regularising existing tariffs. And the purpose of special and differential treatment is not to exclude them from the benefits of liberalisation, but to help the poorest countries to build the capacity to gain from it. And we need the right mix of safeguards and support measures targeted at the poorest to help them integrate at their own pace and with the right support. Now, progress on all these areas will be the key to success in the Doha round. But outside of Doha, there is more that we can do to reduce barriers. First, while on paper many poor countries are offered preferential access to markets, this is often undermined by other barriers. Rules of origin, designed to prevent fraud, can have perverse effects and undermine the ability of countries to buy goods from competitive sources. Yet where these rules have been relaxed, for instance by Canada, it has led to a 50% increase in imports of garments from Bangladesh. The EU is conducting a review of rules of origin now, so we can make a difference this year, and we want the G8 to do the same. Another example is health and other standards, which are becoming new barriers for poor countries. It's not that these countries don't want to meet the standards, but that the cost of doing so can be very high, and the design of standards takes no account of their impact on developing countries. For example, African banana exports could increase by $410 million a year if the EU used internationally accepted standards on pesticide residue rather than their own. There is also much that developing countries can do to remove other barriers to trade that raise their costs and make them less competitive. The delays in getting goods across borders is bad for everyone: developing country exporters, UK importers. A trade facilitation agreement with the right support to implement it can help reduce transaction costs and make the goods of the poorest countries more competitive. What could this mean? In India, an exporter needs 29 documents for clearance in quadruplicate. I think that's four sets, with 257 signatures along the way. Customs delays add almost 1% to the price of goods. And average delays in Ethiopia are over a month. That's a 30% increase in costs. DFID support for customs reform in Mozambique, for example, has helped reduce customs clearance to 24 hours for 80% of goods. At the same time, effective revenue collection has raised revenue from $70 million a year to $250 million a year. Weak governance means that traders moving between Lagos and Abidjan, for example, encounter a roadblock on average every 14 kilometers. These costs add up. The cost of moving a container between Accra and Lagos is three times the cost of moving it to Europe. Transport costs in Africa are twice that of Asia. Secondly, even if markets are opened to the poorest countries and progress made to end rich country subsidies, the poorest countries will not necessarily gain. Why? Because they do not have the capacity to trade in goods and services that can compete in global markets. Working closely with developing countries, the EC, the World Bank and other donors, the UK has led calls for increased aid to enable the poorest countries to build their capacity to trade and adjust to a more open global trading system. And our support must respond to the priorities that they identify. Aid for trade is no substitute for a round that does achieve real benefits for developing countries, but it would help, and both are necessary if we are to achieve that trade justice. The poorest countries will, for example, need investment to improve infrastructure, ports, road, rail, and in energy, water, and telecommunications. Support for investment to create a healthy and a skilled workforce. The Commission for Africa estimated that Africa's infrastructure needs are around $10 billion a year, rising to $20 billion a year necessary to achieve the 7% growth that Africa requires if it is to halve the proportion of its people living on less than a dollar a day by 2015. Infrastructure, however, is not all that is needed. Other priorities for help include trade facilitation, policy reform, and adjustment to the loss of preferences. Some developing countries that are net importers of food will need help because food prices will rise when subsidies reduce. Some countries will experience budget difficulties since tariff income can make up a third of their total revenue and will reduce as tariffs are themselves reduced. And I hope that at the G8 next week at Gleneagles, we can get all those present to agree that we need increased aid to build the poorest countries' capacity to trade, and that at the September meetings of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, we can firm up this support and agree details of how these funds would be dispersed. But thirdly, reduced protectionism and increased aid will not achieve results without strong action by developing countries themselves to create the right environment for trade and development. Sound policies and institutions, an environment where the private sector, from farmers to firms, can operate with the right support and where there's a fairer return for poor producers. An environment that is attractive to local and to foreign investment. Social structures that ensure that people are provided with opportunities through good education and health care to take part in and benefit from the economy, to provide for their families, and social structures which offer a safety net when times are hard. Now, having set out what I think needs to be done, let us recognise that this will not be easy. Trade is not a cure-all. Increased trade alone will not lift millions out of poverty. It has to be accompanied by peace and security, by appropriate economic policies, by good governance, by investment in health and education. People, and above all poor people, need to be provided with the opportunities for productive employment. And for the poorest countries, the challenge is the greatest. And we need to back their efforts with our support and to do more to assist those, in particular in fragile states, where many of the world's poorest people live and who are, in so many ways, excluded for development. Nor am I advocating that poor countries should be forced to liberalise. The poorest and most vulnerable countries do face the biggest challenge, and that's why they need time and help. And we shouldn't underestimate how hard it will be to achieve the concessions that are needed in the WTO. Those that benefit from the status quo will resist change. Change is painful. For example, sugar reforms in Europe affect our farmers and also vulnerable sugar-producing countries. But the truth is, doing nothing would be even worse. And as we've seen with the surge in exports of Chinese textiles, this has led to a protectionist backlash. But what is good for Chinese textile workers and good for African farmers is also good for European and North American consumers and taxpayers. Many Asian countries rose to the challenge of diversifying into more specialist clothing before the end of the multi-fiber agreement in January, but many European and US manufacturers didn't and now want the trade barriers back up again. Now, progress above all is going to demand one thing, and that is political will. And I am greatly encouraged by the efforts of Peter Mandelson, who spoke here in January, and José Manuel Barroso, who spoke here in May, to make development and the needs of the poorest countries a priority for Europe. Political leadership is essential from the EU, from the US, from Japan, and other big players in global trade such as Brazil, India, and China, and the poorest countries in the G92, to approach the negotiations clear on what they want, their red lines, but also clear on the opportunities, especially if they use their strength that they have in numbers. And in the end, this is about the choices that we make. And it is politics. I come back to the point I began with, looking forward to the demonstrations this weekend. It is politics, the political process, that will determine these choices. And it's for that reason that the G8 meeting at Gleneagles next week, the UN Millennium Review Summit in September, and the WTO ministerial in Hong Kong all matter so much. And the UK will carry on doing its utmost, working with the Commission and our European partners, and during our presidency of the EU, which starts on Friday, to take this forward, to work with our developing country partners to ensure that the Doha round meets their needs. A round that actually delivers on the commitments, the bold commitments made in Doha. And I think many people now recognise that a round that really did create trade justice for poor people and for the poorest countries really would be something worth campaigning for and also voting for. And it's up to us to demonstrate that we have the capacity to deliver it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that very radical speech. I was once quoted that the CAP was a crime against humanity. I think it's a crime against the people. That was a nice acronym, the Common Agricultural Policy. But I think it's also very, very good that now we are choosing the WTO as the arena in which to deliver trade justice. Anyway, there must be questions. I throw the floor open. Questions? Yeah, gentlemen here. I'll take please. Keep it short, tell me who you are, and then we go. Yeah. Yes.
What's your name?
What's your name? Yeah.
I'm a student at London Metropolitan University. I know that I'm listening to any part of your speech, but there seems to be one question which will be quite tricky for French and German governments, which is in effect, all the turn to the farmers and say, no, you will have to fend for yourself, we will bring down trade barriers, and you will have to become more competitive. At the same time, we will make African farmers more competitive.
Okay, let me take two or three questions.
Yeah.
There was a hand up there at the back. Yeah, you, yeah.
My name is Gurey, I'm from Paris. You mentioned rightly about the need for infrastructure Africa, how important is infrastructure in Africa. At the same time, my concern is that if you look at the privatization of infrastructure, and you mentioned the example of telecommunications, connecting your rosy steps into the picture that you talked about how telecommunications penetrate Africa. Studies, including your own government's big studies, reveals that Africa is yet to be connected, particularly in rural areas, and it's highly unconnected. And telecommunications investment in Africa is reversing in the last 3 years. That's partly because the market is saturated and communicating. So basically,
what's the question? No. Lady there. It's a matter of equity. If you ask too many questions, others can't. Yeah. Okay, one more question at the back there. Gentleman at the back there.
I think your Prime Minister Blair recently congratulated for the 5% on the agenda.
What's your name? Okay. Lady here. Name. Name.
Which state?
Yeah.
The legislators of the world unite to do the things that you propose. What if you did succeed in that difficult task? How about these huge companies whose budgets exceed those of the countries we want to open and we want?
Okay, one more question. Lady at the back, yeah. Lady at the very back, yeah.
You couldn't speak up. I'm having difficulty in hearing, sorry. Yeah.
Okay, answer those cluster of questions, then we'll take some more.
Okay, right. Can you all hear me? Can you hear in the back?
Yeah.
Right, okay. Right, the first question was about the tricky task, the point that you raised about change for farmers. And I don't underestimate for one second that it's a difficult process, and I made the point, as you would have heard, in my remarks. But the Common Agricultural Policy has itself begun to change. It used to consume, 70% of the EU's budget. It's now down to about 40%. The agreement to decouple subsidies from production, which go back 20 years, people would have said absolutely impossible that that should ever happen. The fact is, this is a process. And the point that I was making is it's a process that's going to have to continue. And in the end, each government has to find a way of negotiating its way through that change in each of its own countries. On infrastructure, well, we went through a phase, who asked the question? Yes, we went through a phase when people said, you know, in the 90s it was rather fashionable to say, hey, the private sector will sort out infrastructure in Africa, leave it to them. It hasn't worked. Now, in the case of mobile telephony, it has largely worked, notwithstanding the point that you make, because in some cases, somebody may not own a mobile telephone, but if somebody in the village has got one and you can rent it for a minute to ring up the market 10 miles down the road and find out what the prices are today to decide whether it's worth taking your products as a poor farmer to market, well, that is helping you to participate in the economy of your region. What's very evident is that for other types of infrastructure investment, roads, water, which I shall come to in a moment, well, the private sector isn't going to deal with that. And so the Africa Commission said, look, we need a big increase in investment. We also need the African Development Bank, which has quite a lot of resources available to it, to be more effective at spending that money, partly because of its own processes, partly because of the procurement rules, partly because when you are doing infrastructure projects that cross the boundaries of more than one country, trying to get people to agree on what is going to happen really matters. But it is the key to lowering the cost of transport. And the point is made in the Africa Commission report. If I could just finish this question on this point. If you lay a map of India on top of a map of Africa, and I know it doesn't quite kind of fit, but looking at the transport links, India is like this. And Africa, the transport links were principally created to get the raw materials to the coast and away from the continent as quickly as possible. And that's one of the reasons why the links aren't there, and therefore the cost of transportation is so high. Now, the third question, our friend from the WDM, well, on GATS and water, the position is very, very clear. If developing countries do not wish to open up their water sector to international activity, they don't have to do so. They don't. And I think we have to be really, really careful here, because in some of the arguments that have been put, and we saw it in relation to the WTO in the past, we just have not got to be patronised. Because in my experience, all the developing country ministers, presidents, prime ministers, finance, and other ministers I meet are absolutely clear about what is in the interests of their own country, are just as capable as you or I in taking decisions about what's in their own best interests, And if they don't want to do it, and they know what they're letting themselves in for if they choose to, they don't have to do it. And I think we should trust them to make their own decision on the basis of what's in the best interests of their country. And what we saw at Cancun amid the failure of the World Trade talks to reach an agreement was developing countries coming together and saying very clearly, we don't like what's on the table and we're not going to sign up to it. And that was the one bright spot, because it demonstrated that the argument of those who said, well, it's all too taxing for these poor developing countries, we shouldn't really press them, were fundamentally mistaken, in my view, because they're just as capable. And the fact is, by coming together in their different groupings, they're showing their power, and in the end, there will be no deal in Hong Kong if it isn't a deal in the give and take of negotiations which is acceptable to developing countries. Now, France and the United States of America are, yes, you've moved, you've come around to my left, over there. Well, look at France. France has now got a timetable for the 0.7%, which wasn't the case before. France is supporting the International Finance Facility. France is looking, together with Germany and Brazil, the Lula Group, at other innovative forms of financing for development. France, frankly, is doing a pretty good job, and we regard them as a strong ally. America, well, to be fair to the United States of America, although their development assistance is low on the 0.7% scale, American aid has, trebled in the last 5 or 6 years. It has. I mean, it is interesting that it's been a Republican administration that has increased American development assistance in a way that the previous Democrat administration did not do. And I make no political point, I make an observation about this. The second thing I would say is that in reaching the debt cancellation agreement, the President of the United States, George Bush, said when the Prime Minister went to Washington, we recognize that additional resources are needed to make this happen. And that was a significant shift, because before then, the argument had been about whether the United States and other countries were prepared to put more money into the deal. And I think that showed that things are moving. Thirdly, there is the Millennium Challenge Corporation, money not yet spent, I think, to the extent that America would like, the PEPFAR program to fight AIDS. And the truth is, when we get to Gleneagles, the pressure is on ourselves and on each other to say, come on, what more can we do? And I think we've already seen signs that that pressure is beginning to have an effect. And in the end, it's all of our responsibility to do something about this. Now, Rita, you raised the question of large companies. Now, going back to the conversations I alluded to with ministers in developing countries that I have on a very regular basis, every single conversation, part of that has been, what can we do to get more foreign investment in our country? Hence the point I made about creating the right climate in which that will come. Because if we look outside of Africa, and there are one or two success stories in Africa, but if we look in other parts of the world, we see that foreign investment is prepared to come in. Look at what's happening in China. Look at what's happening in India. Two countries that are making real progress in lifting their citizens out of poverty. They are. Because in the end, it's a process of economic development that will really make the difference. And therefore, the right climate to encourage that investment to come in. Secondly, in relation to Africa, to change the perception, because too much of the coverage and the discussion somehow sees Africa as the one country. Yeah. It's not. It's over 50 countries, very diverse. And for all the problems of famine and war and so on, there are countries that are making real progress. And if we could get people to see that that is the case, begin to think about Africa as a source, a place where people could put their investment, then I think we can help to see change happen. Two other things I'd mention very quickly. One is in relation to extractive industries, oil, gas, minerals. The Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative, which the Prime Minister launched over 2 years ago, is making real progress on a very simple principle. Companies publish what you're paying to the government, government publish what you're receiving from the companies. And the great virtue in that is that if people know what's coming in, then the people of the country can ask of their government, what have you done with the money? Mm. And in the end, it's democratic politics, a relationship between government and the people, government with the capacity to deliver, people with the expectation that government might actually be able to do something for them, and that isn't the case in every country in Africa or around the world, then the process can begin to develop. And the other is the Ethical Trading Initiative, where big companies that are sourcing a lot of supplies from the developing world are coming together with trade unions and others to ask themselves the question, how can we ensure that we source it in an ethical and a transparent and an open and a beneficial way? And I think most companies in the end, in my experience, want to do the right thing. There's a small number who don't, but most do, and we want them to be supported in that process. And that links me really to the final question from our colleague at the back about consumers. Well, of course, through the fair trade movement, consumers don't have to wait for the WTO talks to reach an agreement, because you can go out this afternoon, or, you know, something we do every day or every week, and make a decision in buying a fairly traded product, and there's a growing number of them available. Originally it was just it was chocolate and coffee, and now it's flowers and orange juice and footballs and you name it. There's a growing number of fairly traded products, and it means that you know the person on the other end of that transaction is getting a reasonable day's pay for their labour, whatever it is. And that's why it's such a powerful idea. That's why the sales of fairly traded products have grown enormously in the last decade. And as Britain, we give support to the Fair Trade Foundation to help them to bring more products to market. Secondly, consumers, by indicating that they don't want the companies from which they buy to source their products in unethical ways. This is a very powerful force that big companies, and it links to Rita's point, big companies have to respond to. Nike recently published a report admitting that some of the conditions in some of the factories that supply them weren't up to scratch. That seems to me to be a very powerful indicator of the pressure which consumers, by the choice they make to buy or not to buy, and the message that they send, the powerful impact that they can have on the decisions that multinational companies make.
Thank you. Okay, now lots of hands are up. I won't be able to take all of you. Gentleman here first, then the gentleman there. Yeah, keep it short. Gentlemen there. Yeah, do you see a possible conflict between the UK government's development objectives to increase trade flows and the UK government's environmental objectives to reduce carbon dioxide? Yeah, okay. The lady there, yeah. No, the lady there, yeah. Mm. Yes. Yeah, you. Good, good. Stephen Wilcock, yeah.
Come on. Stephen Wilcock from the LSE. You didn't talk much about bilateral agreements. You talked about David and Goliath.
Yep.
Can you make bilateral agreements or region-to-region agreements compatible with trade justice? Or are you saying that the WTO is a much better tool?
Okay. Yeah, hands. Lady here in red. Yeah. Or pink. Can you speak up?
Yeah.
Okay. The gentleman at the back there. No, behind you. Yeah, you, in the glasses. Glasses on my right hand. Across from you. Yeah, you. No, behind you. Yeah, okay. Lady there, and red, yeah.
Okay, that's it.
That's
enough. Okay, all right. Right, corruption. Yes, yeah. The question that you asked. Well, I'm a very strong supporter of the African peer review mechanism. The summary report on Ghana is, I think, just now out. Rwanda is going to be the second country. And I think all of us are going to look with great interest at what that shows, because it's a pretty radical concept, the African peer review mechanism. Imagine us doing that in Europe. Mm-hmm. Eh? And the proof will be, what has it got to say about what it's found? And crucially, what are the countries going to do about what's been found as a result of the process? Now, on corruption, well, yes, tackling corruption is fundamental to this, because one of the things that will put off people coming and investing in a country from within that country and from elsewhere is the problem, the prospect that they're going to find themselves mired in a culture where they're required to give bribes in those circumstances. And I think if one looks, take Nigeria. I think Nigeria is a really good example, because this is a country that has suffered grievously from corruption, from military dictatorship and bad management. There is a process of change now beginning in Nigeria. We're seeing some very high profile corruption cases being brought to court. There is a very active Economic and Financial Crimes Commission led by Mr. Ribadu, who I met when I was there about a month ago. I was very impressed. There's been reform of public financial management. Finance Minister Ngozi and her team are, I think, doing an outstanding job. Look at Zambia, where there's a drive against corruption and prosecutions. Look at the decision that President Mbeki made about his deputy recently. I think those are all signs that when Africa says we have a responsibility to deal with the things that we can do something about, that process of change is beginning, and it applies in other countries around the world. And if corruption isn't tackled, then it's going to make life very difficult for economic development. And through our development program, we provide support to a lot of anti-corruption commissions as the UK. I think the last thing I would say is that there are things that we can do as countries where the corruptly acquired money may end up. And we have strengthened our money laundering legislation. We have made bribery by UK citizens abroad an offence triable in the UK courts. We are trying to improve the help that we can give to developing countries when they're trying to get back the stolen assets. And we are committed to ratify the UN Convention on Corruption. Now, it's got to be a partnership. Action to prevent the corruption happening in the first place. If it does and the money's nicked and it ends up somewhere else, those countries need to have effective mechanisms for helping it to be given back to the people to whom it really belongs, the people of the countries from which it was stolen. Is there a conflict between trade and CO2 emissions? Well, your question brings together the two issues for the G8 summit, Africa and climate change. Now, the truth is that in the long term, we are going to have to reach an agreement on tackling climate change, which includes all of the countries of the world. So far, Kyoto has just covered most of the large developed country emitters, with one particular exception, the United States of America, which will not sign up to Kyoto. I made the point about China and its developing economy. China is very rapidly coming up the inside track and will be a major emitter of CO2 in the not too distant future. And so we're going to have to find an agreement, and it will have to be an agreement in which we do not say to developing countries, you know that economic growth we've had, which has enabled us to improve our lives, educate our children, provide healthcare, sorry, the world can't take it anymore, because rightly they won't accept it. And the challenge will be to find a way that we, who are using more of our share of the Earth's resources currently, can scale back on that share in order to allow space for developing countries themselves to develop. And that really is the big challenge. On money, on trade, building the capacity of developing countries to trade, to understand what's on the table, to take cases and so on. Well, we've honoured that commitment. Sorry, who asked the question?
Yes,
we have honoured that commitment, and from memory, I think we committed well over £150 million, and I think it certainly provided the kind of support and help that developing countries want, because while they're absolutely clear about what's in their own interests, sometimes they need assistance in order to understand precisely what the implications of particular trade proposals are going to be. And I can think of, well, when I was in Zambia recently, talking to the trade minister, expressing appreciation about the help that we've given in the expenditure of that money. On regional agreements versus the WTO. Well, in the end, the WTO is the place where all of these things can be brought together, and where I think we have the best chance of reaching agreements that will really make a difference. But to take one aspect of regional agreements, and that's something we haven't talked about already, thinking of Africa in particular, but it would also apply elsewhere, there is still great potential for regional agreements on customs unions and trading areas within Africa, which, and we're seeing some progress on that already, where by actions that Africa itself takes and the different regional economic commissions could increase the opportunities for trade, create bigger markets, and derive a lot of the benefits that we can see from that approach in the same way that we have done in Europe. On special and differential treatment, well, indeed, the WTO is going to need to address that. I've set out, I hope, as clearly as I can, why it matters, and why, although we are all moving in the same direction, not all every country can proceed at the same pace. And the precise nature of the agreement that is reached on special and differential treatment is going to be the key to getting a deal, because it goes back to the point I was making in answer to your question, because depending on what's agreed on special differential treatment, that will determine how developing countries who have different interests, you know, this is the key point, they don't all have the same interests, who have different interests, respond to what has been agreed. On specific ideas for things we can do in Europe, well, one very specific thing that we are campaigning for as Britain is saying that the end date for export subsidies ought to be 2010. That was a manifesto commitment on which we were returned to government very recently. So that's moving from the EU's current, the EU's current position is there is agreement to set an end date as yet not specified. The UK now working within Europe to say that 2010 should be that date. And it seems to me that's a very practical response to the question you've rightly asked about how that process of change takes place. And finally, on EPAs, well, I mean, I saw the letter that was sent by the Commission official around the world. I think it was published extremely helpfully in The Guardian. All I would say is I profoundly disagree with the assessment that was made in that letter about what we'd done and why we'd done it. And we agreed that policy statement on EPAs because Patricia Hewitt, who was then the minister, and myself and others were absolutely convinced that it was the right approach to take. What are we doing? One, we've set up, we've proposed the establishment of an expert group which will focus particularly on EPAs in the 133 committee. We're talking to other EU member states. We're also talking to the countries that are participating in the EPA negotiations. Now, I have to say, on the basis of the conversations that I've had, in general, people say, well, it's still too early to say what the outcome is going to be. But I think the approaches that we set out in that policy document are the right one, because it seems to me that they would turn into reality what the EPAs are meant to be about. And EPAs are meant to be about development. Now, the proof of that will be in what's agreed. And developing countries have the same safeguard in the EPA negotiations that they have in the WTO. If they don't like what's on the table, they don't have to sign up to it. And that's very, very important.
Well, thank you very much. Hilary Benn has to go at 2 o'clock. He has a daytime job he has to do. He doesn't really spend all his time at LSE, but I'll promise him, I won't tell Charles Clark that he has been to the LSE, because you know, there is war going on. But thank you very much. I think the question of trade today is going to be as important as it was in British politics 160 years ago. We removed the corn laws, we abolished tariffs on agricultural imports, and if only all of Europe and America could follow that example, the third world would be much better off. And that is a movement he is going to join in Edinburgh, and I hope lots of you join it as well. Thank you very much. Brilliant.
Thank you, my friend.